From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. David Staley is the director of the Harvey Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching at The Ohio State University in the Department of History. He is also the author of two books, Computers, Visualization, and History, How New Technology Will Transform Our Understanding of the Past, and his most recent, History and Future, Using Historical Thinking to Imagine the Future. Welcome, Dr. Staley, to Writer's Talk.
Thanks very much, Doug.
Sure. Well, tell me about writing history. We'll start with a basic question. What are the hallmarks of writing history? How is writing history different than many other genres, besides the fact that it's writing about, I assume, the past, but not for you?
You know, this is something I've wrestled with for a number of years.
Good.
I had a colleague in an English department years ago ask me exactly this sort of question. Mm-hmm. The question was, how much imagination are historians allowed to have? Mm-hmm. And I looked back and I said, well, none, because we're historians and we talk about factual things. And but, you know, I've been wrestling with that question for about 10 years now.
I haven't answered it yet.
You know, I haven't.
Well, I'm glad I asked a variation of it then to start you off. Yeah.
You know, because what my colleague was doing was trying to figure out the difference between being a novelist or a short story writer who writes about the past and being an historian. And I think what I finally settled down in is that historians tell stories that purport to be the truth.
Mm-hmm. Purport.
Yeah.
But not are. That's an interesting choice you've made of a verb there.
And a very deliberate choice. Well, and you know, there's a big debate in history about can we really encapsulate the truth? And there's one group of historians that say no, so let's just write about whatever we want about the past.
What are they called, unemployed historians?
Well,
or what do you call that group of?
They're actually called postmodern historians, if you want the fancy name for it. But when I say purport, it's I think every historian understands that. We can sort of asymptotically approach the truth, but we can never fully achieve it. We don't have all the information there is to the past. There's always new ways to think about, interpret the past. We're constantly revising. We're constantly rewriting our understanding of the past. And so any claim that we can come to the truth mm-hmm. about the past, we always treat, I think, with some circumspection, some hesitation, I think.
Okay. Well, tell me about the history of your writing. To flip this a little bit, how did you get interested in writing history or history? Were you fascinated with it as a kid, as so many people were? I was really into Lincoln when I was young. Okay, so I outrank you.
This is the weirdest thing. I was never a history buff.
Really?
Well, you know, that's not true. For about 6 months in fifth grade, I was really into the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. right? You know, knights and damsels in distress and that kind of thing. But I never really had an intrinsic love of the past. I came to history in college fairly late. I was probably a junior. I was an economics and political science guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of overlap, though. You've got you know, the history and overlapping with economics.
But it's the areas that don't overlap that were most interesting to me. Historians, social scientists want regularity in laws and prediction, especially the economists. And historians are interested in sort of messiness and complexity. And I made an aesthetic choice one day. Economists studied rational man. And I was studying enough history to say that, you know, I don't think there are a lot of rational men in history. And I was very much interested in the way historians think about human beings and human behavior than what social scientists were doing. The writing is another part. Writing came, I think, slowly and painfully to me, well into graduate school.
It's a good admission on a show called Writer's Talk.
It is, isn't it?
Writing was painful. And we've had that before, though.
It still comes across as very odd to me to be described as a writer. I mean, I'll take that as a compliment. But to still think of myself as a writer mm-hmm. it still sounds a little odd coming off the tongue.
Well, you know, it's interesting because then it suggests to me that there's a conception of you can be a writer and be a historian, but can you be a historian and not be a writer? Or is that just being academic writing?
No. History is, at its root, I think, a written discipline. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's what I argued in my first book. And my first book, Computers, Visualization, and History, was as much an argument to historians to say, you know, the past can be represented in forms other than writing. And so it was as much a, it was much an argument that we should take film seriously, we should take computer visualization seriously. It sometimes falls on deaf ears, though. I mean, we think of ourselves as writers first.
Yeah, because it's a recent form, though, of a recording of the past. I mean, video is 150 years old at this point. I'm not really sure when the first images were produced.
Photographs, maybe the 1840s.
Yeah, so or a little bit more. But, you know, not that long to for these sorts of records. And then how do you read that? And as a historian, what was your answer to, okay, you've got the video, here's a certain brand of history, it's one lens looking at something. How is that? Is that a historical artifact? Is that do you recognize it as a creation during that point?
As a creation. And it was in thinking through a lot of that I really came to an understanding of what it means to be a writer. And that's what you were, that was your original question about the historian as writer. For me, if anything, writing was sort of a means to an end. That's the way I always approached it, you know, throughout college, certainly. Got to write this in order to get the grade, whatever that might be. And then I sort of woke up one day and decided I wanted to become interested in good writing.
Okay.
And became very interested in reading things try to understand what good writing was.
Well, then, what was your idea of that? What then defined good writing for you? Who were some of the good writers that you said these are going to be my models?
As odd as it sounds, Umberto Eco,
okay. The
Italian academic semiotician. Have you ever read Semiotics before, Doug?
I have tried to on some occasions.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Right. But he wrote The Name of the Rose.
He did.
Book.
Yes, and I read The Name of the Rose, and I thought, boy, here's this really challenging, really well-written novel, written by this guy who, you know, whose sentences I simply couldn't understand as a semiotician.
And that's what you strove for in the book.
Well, you know, I also started to read some of Eco's journalism. He was a newspaper columnist. Mm-hmm. And so here was someone who was inhabiting lots of different sort of written worlds, I suppose, sort of this very dense, incomprehensible academic writing. He was a successful novelist. He was also a newspaper columnist, and I told myself that's the sort of writer I want to be with facility.
A fractured sense, though, and so or it, maybe
fluid.
It's a fluid.
Fluid,
not
fractured. Fluid,
right? Okay.
Because his voice is still there, I think, in each one of them. But the idea of writing to audience, and for me, the idea was what I took out of all this was writing to be clear. I decided I didn't want to be a writer in this academic sense. And I did that. I went through that phase in my life where I thought that writing impenetrable prose made one sort of look smart and intelligent, mm-hmm. and it really doesn't. It makes one look unintelligible. And I decided I wanted to aim for clarity. And the highest praise I've received on both my books is that they're both clearly written. Because for me, clear writing is the same thing as clear thinking.
Although in some academic circles, I imagine that's sort of damning praise.
It is.
Oh, it was so clear.
Anyone could read it.
Say about a book like this. So
let's go to the book then. It's called History and Future, Using Historical Thinking to Imagine the Future. And how does one do that? How do you use historical thinking to imagine the future? What's behind that thought?
The idea behind it is for many people, the counterintuitive notion that history is a method of thought, not just a subject matter, but that to be an historian is to think in a certain way, in the same way that being an economist means thinking in a certain way, or being a mathematician, or being an artist means thinking in a certain way. And I was struck by the notion that that the way historians do what they do, and what we do is we study the past, is a method of thought or a habit of thought that one can use to think about the future.
Okay. Give me an example.
Well, I'll tell you how the moment crystallized for me. How's that?
Okay.
I was reading Peter Schwartz's book, The Art of the Long View, which is a treatise really on the scenario method, which is a technique that futurists use to think about the future. So I'm reading this book on scenarios, and at every page I'm saying, this is exactly what I do as an historian, mm-hmm. except what Schwartz is doing is looking forward, and what I do is look back.
Okay.
And that was sort of the germ of the idea of sort of exploring the way historians approach problems, the way futurists or scenarists approach problems, I decided I wanted to write a book that explored those two domains.
For traditional historians, mm-hmm. I imagine that represents something of an unusual view, mm-hmm. one that they might have disagreements.
Yes.
How did that work for you? What was the reaction to that kind of thought?
We sort of fall into two camps. We historians fall into two camps when it comes to discussing the uses of history and the future. The first is we just don't do it. So the whole enterprise is just not worth it.
And imagine people smoking pipes saying, "We just don't do that."
there is a serious reason behind it. And I think those historians assume that when you're talking about the future, you're talking about predictions. Mm-hmm. And I argue, I think fairly clearly in the book, that I'm not talking about making predictions. Prediction assumes that the future already exists someplace. It's already there, and all we have to do is sort of map out what that future looks like. I don't believe the future exists already. It's something that's still forming. Mm-hmm. And so you can't predict something that's still forming. You can make statements about it. You can write narratives about it. And that's really what historians do, I think, is write narratives. So that's sort of one approach. The other approach are those historians that say, well, yes, we can comment on the future because as an historian, I've studied and I understand the rhythms and cycles and patterns of the past. And since I've discovered these, I can take these patterns and project them forward.
That's
Marx, Hegel, mm-hmm. Spengler. You can name all these historians that have done this.
Well, that's the sort of those who are do not know the past are doomed to repeat it.
Precisely.
Which was it's a quote that I've always thought, well, that's really cool, but even if you do know the past, show me the historians who've managed to avoid
yes.
the problems of the future.
And that is the problem. I reject this notion, too, the idea that there are these rhythms and patterns in the past. I think there are patterns. I just don't think there are sort of periods to them. Or, mm-hmm. There's not a regular flow to right. events like that.
Whenever something like economics is described as cyclic, I think, well, sure, but you don't know what the cycle is. You right. don't know how long it's going to take to go from one to the other. Therefore, it seems kind of pointless to me. So that's sort of one of the things I've thought about futurism is, like you say, it's in flux. It can be altered at any moment by something else. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that as saying, all right, here is my training as a historian saying this is how we look at these certain kinds of episodes, and then I'm going to apply that to what? If you're not making predictions, then what does it do?
That's where the historical thinking part comes in.
Okay.
What I do in the book is I sort of break down, almost in sort of point-by-point fashion, here's what historians do. When we're doing history, okay. these are the sorts of things that historians do. So the first thing we do is we seek out evidence. I say in the book, maybe it's somewhat glib, but I still think it's true, that historians really don't study the past. They study the things that are left over from the past. Mm-hmm. We study documents, we study records, we study artifacts. And I think when you study the future, you have to do the same thing. There are sort of artifacts and documents for things that will happen.
Okay.
And so the first thing a futurist who's an historian does is sort of find or locate evidence in the present. And then as an historian, I take that evidence and I try to piece it all together and to draw inferences from that evidence. And I do the same
predictions, but inferences.
Right. And I do the same thing as a futurist. I draw inferences from this. And those inferences, of course, are based on my judgment.
Mm-hmm.
As an historian, I make...
Training, you mean.
Yes. But I mean judgment, too. I think that historians are trained to exercise judgment. Okay. And I talk a lot in the book about the kind of judgment that historians engage in. It's the same sort of judgments I think that futurists make. To that end, historians, after they've drawn their inferences from their evidence, they construct narratives about the past. And I think we do the same thing as futurists. We construct narratives about the future. As an historian, those narratives are always provisional. It's our best estimate, our best guess as to how the meaning of the past. But if you provide new evidence, if you provide a new way of interpreting that data, then we alter or we even remove that particular narrative. It's the same thing about the future. The future, to me, is a collection of narratives about the future.
Okay.
And if there's new evidence, if there are new ways of thinking about the future, we alter, we change, we even jettison those narratives that are no longer useful.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University.
My guest is David Staley, the director of the Harvey Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching at The Ohio State University and author of History and Future, Using Historical Thinking to Imagine the Future, which recently came out in paperback. You can also watch our interview at www.ohiochannel.org. Now let's get back to my discussion with Dr. Staley about how historians and futurists treat information that turns out to no longer be accurate. What do you think the relative difference is between the way you discard narratives for the future and the way that narratives of the past are changed? It seems like the futurist, obviously, you're going to throw away a lot of stories much more frequently.
Yes.
And that's part of the inherent thing that probably traditional historians say, well, you know, you guys throw away 10-to-1 narratives to what we toss out.
Yes, I think so. More of them, more frequently, but not with the kind of speed you might imagine. Because there are, I think, entrenched ideas and pictures about the future. Okay. I do a little bit of work with organizations and helping them thinking about the future. And every organization has this sort of, accepted, approved vision of the future. And I'm oftentimes brought in to organizations to say, tell us a different narrative. We got to get out of this. They don't use that kind of language. But in a sense, what they want me to do is tell us a different story.
Well, that's got to be, do you then construct retroactively the history of the organization to meet something that you're saying, okay, here's your possible narrative to the future, but in order to get there, we have to interpret these things differently in the past.
Yes.
Is that part of the writing? See, because what you're talking about there is, it's a form of writing. You're rewriting one kind of narrative to the past to write a narrative to the future, literally writing a narrative for the future.
Yeah. Or sometimes it's getting an organization to see a different narrative of the past than what they're accustomed to. But in each case, and this is something I've discovered only in about the last year or so, that when it comes to constructing narratives about the future, what individuals want, what organizations want, those who contract with me, is they want someone to make meaning for them. Mm-hmm. And that's really what narrative is, both in the past and the future. It's about, all right, looking backward. We have all this data. We have all this information. What does it all mean? And it's the difference between history and chronology. Chronology is just this happened on this date, this happened on this date, this happened, this happened. History is piecing together, putting those events, those data points together to say, here's what it all means. Mm-hmm. And essentially that's what I do when I'm writing about the future, I think, is I'm saying, here are all these possibilities, here's what I think it all means.
Okay. How do you write about the future? What's your process? You sit down and you have different things clustered around you that you're going to use as evidence for one thing or another. The way you described writing in before was it was a means to an end. Mm-hmm. You said, I just need to get this done. And I feel you have changed that way of writing. You're saying, I'm writing to sort of teach myself something or to explore something or to create a narrative that will make sense to somebody else.
And to be clear. Yes.
All these four things. So what's your process for that?
It's a very similar kind of process. I just did a project with an organization up in Michigan. And literally they gave me a stack of materials, and what they wanted me to do was to make sense out of it. And so what I did is I came in and I told them a story.
Okay.
This was in particular the story was this is what Michigan's economy used to look like. Michigan's economy is going to look like this. It can't be about automobiles anymore.
But that's your inference and not your prediction.
Or it is an inference. It is a story. It is a it's a narrative, right? Okay. But it's not a prediction. And it sounds like I'm playing sort of academic games, but I really do think a prediction assumes a kind of certainty. I know for a fact that this is going to happen. I can only speak about the future in terms of probabilities. But the funny thing is that's the way it is with the past, too. I can only talk in probabilities about the past.
Tell me why. I mean, what is there that's a probability in the past that what kind of events are probabilities in the past that you don't say this happened?
Right. Well, for instance, I know when the Declaration of Independence was signed. But I was listening to NPR this morning, a story of a freed slave who ended up moving to New York and falling in love with and marrying what she thought to be another African American. He actually turned out to be white. which is a very interesting kind of story. And the question they posed to this historian was, didn't she know that her husband was white? And she says, I don't know the answer to that, because we just don't have the evidence for it. But, she said, I can surmise, given what I know about this person, given the evidence that does exist, I can surmise that she didn't. She really didn't. That's a statement based on probability, right? We don't know for certain, but we can judge pretty closely what we think the answer is. But it's ultimately based on probability. Ultimately based on judgment. I know you weren't comfortable with that word judgment before, but it is. As historians, we make judgments, I think.
Well, I was just asking. I'm all comfortable with anything. There mentioned the historical method and the scenario method. Mm-hmm. Tell me what the difference is between those two.
Very little. Which is why I wrote the book. No, I mean, I quite seriously, it is. I was really struck by how those who construct scenarios really could be historians. In fact, Schwartz says in the book, the scenario method does not come easy to a lot of people, but it does come fairly easily to historians. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, yeah, because what scenarios are doing is the same thing historians do. And what a scenarist does is gathers in information, draws inferences from that information, and constructs stories, plural. This is part of what makes the scenario method distinct from predictions, because a scenarist always thinks in terms of more than one story. You always have to presume that the future could go in any one of several directions. And so you try to write those different narratives, those different stories going in different directions. So when I make statements about the future, it's always in the plural, never in the singular.
Give me an example of how you're going to do that. You're talking to a group of people and saying the future of this group could be these four things you choose. I mean, how do you...
If we were doing something like a visioning exercise, you choose, yeah, sure, that's the way to do it. But the idea is to really highlight uncertainty, that the future is still forming and that we are at root uncertain about it. And the way that I express my uncertainty is say, it could go this way, it could go this way, it could go this way.
How do you convince somebody that you're talking to them about the three ways that something could happen, that there's value in knowing those three ways? If you don't then use your judgment to say, this is the way I think it's going to go, or this is the most likely, do you attach a probability to those statements?
We do, yes. And the way I do this is that I don't attach the probability.
You give it to them.
Exactly. Well, and in fact, we just did an exercise with a library association where we produced 26 scenarios on the future environment in which libraries are going to be operating over the next 15 years. We presented 26 scenarios. Mm-hmm. And we sent out a mass survey. I mean, we're talking about, I think we had 500 or so respondents. And we asked them to sort of evaluate, what's the probability this is going to happen? What's the impact going to be on libraries that this happens? And we plotted this all out in something I call scenario space. And what I'm at pains to say when we're talking about the scenario space is that this is not a map of the future. It's a map of our perceptions about the future. And those perceptions can alter and change. It's been a big hit, I'm told. But precisely because it allowed this group to articulate their expectations about the future. But what I tell them is, come back to this document in 6 months and watch and see if any of your expectations about the future have changed. Mm-hmm. Something that you thought was, well, there's little chance of that happening, is now suddenly much more probable.
Mm-hmm. And see if it jumps.
Yeah.
From one to another. 6 months follow one track, but then suddenly there's a way for it to go and follow another track. And then is there an interest in the kind of stuff that you're talking about, to going back and looking at what you said were, here are some possibilities, and seeing how accurate they were, or how much the probabilities seem to align with what you were discussing?
Yeah, retro forecasting is the term that I've just heard for it. And it's meant to be a learning opportunity. You look at the predictions, you look at the scenarios you developed, and especially those you got wrong. And then you ask yourself, why? Why did we get them wrong? What were our assumptions then? And can that help us think about the assumptions that we're working under today?
How long has retro forecasting been around? How much writing is on it?
The term?
Well, the
still
idea.
Fairly new. The idea, I think, is still fairly new as well, at least among professional futurists. I think the idea is still fairly new.
Okay, so you don't...
The idea of learning from your mistakes.
Right, yeah, it's somehow new in the economy.
Of course, I don't see them as mistakes. Yeah,
they were probabilities that didn't pan out.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. It's like a weather forecaster that says, you know, there's a 10% chance of rain tomorrow, and it rains.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a 10% chance it was going to rain, and it turned out that was the
eventually that forecast gets fired.
You know? That's right. But yeah, we weren't anticipating rain.
Right.
Yes.
So I shouldn't be asking you for stock market tips.
No.
And things like that. So no. That's not where you're going to go with the history of the writing of the future.
When I'm giving presentations, I always like to start off with something to the effect of anybody that says they can predict the future is selling you snake oil. Mm-hmm. And that usually puts audiences back on their heels.
What's the response after they rock back from their heels? Do they say, well, what are you here for?
Exactly. That's usually it. And what I'll say is, you know, then I'll backtrack and I'll say, well, you know, there are some things we can predict with a fair amount of certainty. I know that this coming January in Columbus, it's going to be cold. Mm-hmm. I can say that with a fair amount of certainty, but that's also a fairly trivial thing to say, right? We all know if you live in Columbus long enough, you know that it's going to be cold here in January. The sorts of things that we're really interested about in the future are precisely the things that we're uncertain about. And when you begin with uncertainty, what I say is that what I do when I write about the future is try to manage that uncertainty, try to put some boundaries, try to put some meaning around that uncertainty.
Okay. My last question is the Harvey Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching. You are the director of this at The Ohio State University. Tell me about why is it situated in a Department of History?
I guess that's an accident of history. Harvey Goldberg was a professor in the history department from 1950 to 1963. Mm-hmm. And evidently an outstanding, every story I've heard is that he was an outstanding educator.
He has an exceptionally detailed Wikipedia page, by the way. I don't know if the Harvey Goldberg Center had anything to do with that.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. But it is an exceptionally detailed history of the Harvey Goldberg.
Yeah. His students wanted to honor him, and so they were the first donors to what became the Harvey Goldberg Center. So that's the reason that's the specific reason it's centered in the history department.
Okay. And the kinds of work that you do there sort of quickly at the end?
We are the technology catalyst in the history department. We're interested in history and new media and new media applications. We are the publisher of two textbooks and an online news magazine called Origins, Current Events and Historical Perspective, that I'd encourage everyone to read. Okay. And we engage in significant public outreach.
Okay. Well, David Staley, I want to thank you very much for being here on Writer's Talk. The book, again, is History and the Future, Using Historical Thinking to Imagine the Future. And you've got, I know that authors generally don't have a lot of say on the cover, but on their cover you've got A Tree and the Roots. And I thought that was an interesting expression.
I chose that.
Okay. And I won't make any comments about, you know, from such a nut comes the mighty oak or something like that, because that would be wrong, and I won't do that. But I want to thank you for being here today.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk with my guest David Staley, the director of the Harvey Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching at The Ohio State University and author of History and Future, Using Historical Thinking to Imagine the Future, which recently came out in paperback. You can read more about David Staley at www.writerstalk.org. Writer's Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel, whose website at www.ohiochannel.org has plenty of links to my author interviews. Join me next time for author Jane Smiley and her thoughts on her recent book, Private Life.
Private Life is about a woman who's born shortly after the Civil War, and she in a small town in Missouri, central Missouri, and she's a good girl. She's the fan. She says one of her sisters is the pretty one, one of her sisters is the smart one, and she's the other one. And she gets to her late 20s without being married, and then she's married off to what seems like a great guy. He's the town genius. He's an astronomer and a physicist, and he's been educated in Berlin, and he has worked in Washington and Chicago at the University of Chicago. And so they move to California, where he takes up a position at Mare Island, which is the naval shipbuilding site in California near San Francisco. And then the book is a lot of the book is about their marriage and what it's like to be married to a quote-unquote genius, to someone who truly, truly believes that he has all the answers. A lot of books are about the genius and his point of view or her point of view, whether he or she is vindicated or not. But I would keep the person in the background.
Until then, this is Doug Dangler at The Ohio State University saying, keep writing.